was written about 430 BC, so about 430 years before Christ. This was written to Israel after they had been brought back out of exile from Babylonia in Persia. The temple had been rebuilt about 50 years before. The prophet Zechariah, actually, or Zechariah, depending on what kind of English you're speaking, writes about rebuilding the temple. They had been neglecting it. And then actually Nehemiah, which comes well before Malachi, talks about rebuilding the city, specifically the city walls, and that was actually 12 years before Malachi. So they're back in Jerusalem, they're back in the land that was promised to them, and all the major building projects are done. So the people of Israel say, whew, we don't need to worry about it anymore. And that's where we find ourselves today. A slight turn is we don't actually know who wrote Malachi. Malachi actually means his messenger or his angel. He's not actually named, or the person who wrote it is not actually named. Origen, who occasionally has some good things to say but was eventually a heretic, said that an angel wrote it and gave it to the people. But we do know that the title, his messenger, moves on. And then our Bibles will say, hey, this is by Malachi. And we think that's the name of the prophet, but it's actually a title. And it's easier for us to understand who that might be by giving him a name, which is his messenger. So his messenger writes to the people of Israel. It's broken up into a couple different, the whole book is broken up into a couple different prophecies and calls for action. And actually the first half of the book is calling out the priests of the people. The priests are called cheats and liars, and their offerings are polluted. That is a real positive way to start a book. Especially if you're a priest preaching on this. So, hopefully, that is not what's going to happen today. But the Lord actually tells them that the priests, the leaders of the people, their faces are covered in dung by their offering. Which is an interesting picture. Basically, what he's saying is that the offerings they're offering is worthless and actually making them unclean instead of cleansing them as the offerings should. And the reason why that's happening is because the priests, as leaders of the people and teachers of the people, are teaching the people something wrong. They are not giving their best. They are giving their least wanted. So God actually calls them out for offering blind animals and ill animals as offering instead of what the Lord demanded, which is the first and the best. So that's the first half of the book. And now we come into here, and this is where the Lord actually calls out the whole rest of the nation. So the passage starts in verse 6 of Malachi. For I, the Lord, do not change. This is chapter 3, by the way. Do not change. Therefore you, O children of Jacob, are not consumed. That first verse actually talks a lot about God's character. His changelessness. Numbers 23:19 says, God is not man that he should lie, or a son of man that he should change his mind. As he said, and will he not do it? Has he said, and will he not do it? Or has he spoken, and will he not fulfill it? God is changeless. Lamentations 3:22 says, "The steadfast love of the Lord never ceases. His mercies never come to an end." Isn't that a great thing to know, that our Lord doesn't change? Hebrews 13:8 says, "Jesus Christ is the same yesterday, today, and forever." What the Lord expects of his people is not ever changing. It's not like a human being. What he says is what he expects. I've been in a couple relationships where it's been questionable as to what was expected of me. And it might have changed from week to week, which made that relationship a little turbulent, shall we say. The Lord is not like that. We also, in that passage, have, "O children of Jacob, are not you, O children of Jacob, are not consumed." That says that even though you were in exile and now you're brought back, you could have been destroyed. But I made a promise to you, and I'm keeping that promise. You're back where I said you would be. The prophet continues, "From the days of your fathers, you have turned aside from my statutes and have not kept them. Return to me, and I will return to you, says the Lord of hosts." I don't know about you, but right in the middle, "your fathers turned aside from my statutes," comes directly to mind to Exodus 32, where the people have just been saved and brought out of Egypt and saved from destruction from the army. And they go, and Moses goes up on the mountain and is talking to God and learning what the people are expected to do. And what do the people do? They melt down all their gold and make a golden calf. They started out not being able to follow the statutes. He said, "Follow me." And when they got to a place, a lull, where it was looking kind of interesting, kind of good, they're like, "No, no, 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 no. We don't need you anymore. We're going to make a golden calf. We're not even going to find something to worship. We're going to make it ourselves." The book of Judges has a lot of, well, Israel was in a bad place. The Lord sent a prophet. They turned around for a little while, and they were in a good place. And then they turned around and went a little on the wrong side, and God called them back. God is constantly calling people back, especially to what he's called them to do. The prophet Jeremiah puts it like this: "The heart is deceitful above all things and desperately sick. Who can understand it?" He's speaking about the heart of man. The problem is that God is changeless, and man, humans, are ever changing. So if we want to get right with God, it's not him getting right with us. We need to get right with him. Their forefathers mess up all the time. The heart of the people changes because of their desires. People change and God doesn't. So, what makes them then, Israel then, and us now, think that God will change the way he functions? It's kind of delusional, actually. What's the mark of insanity? Trying to get a different outcome by doing the same thing over and over and over again. We're constantly trying to get God to change the way he works for us so that we're right with him, so that we don't have to do anything. But God doesn't work like that. And in fact, the the way that the prophet responds as the people's voice is pretty much a given. He says, but you say, how shall we return? Verse 8, will man rob God? Yet you are robbing me. But you say, how have we robbed you? In your tithes and contributions, you are cursed with a curse, for you are robbing me, the whole nation of you. I don't have any children, but I do have small nieces and nephews. And I've seen something interesting while they have been growing up. And even secular media catches on this phenomena, but they don't really understand what's going on. So, what do you think are some of the first words out of children's mouths? Or maybe I should say, what are the most used words by children and actually adults? Mine and no. Even in families where they're like, we're never going to use the word no in front of our kids, they pick it up somewhere else and they throw it like a brick. No, I'm not going to eat broccoli. Or mine. I'm not sharing with my brother or sister. Why would I? It's mine. It's mine. The only way to change that is through the instruction of their parents and grandparents, that this born-in habit is broken. And it can take a long, long time. And is something that we will still struggle with throughout all of our days. Because that car is mine, and that house is mine, and that guitar is mine. It's my computer, it's my library, it's my books, it's my fun. It's mine, mine, mine. Here's the problem. It's not. In my mind, it's mine. But in all reality, it's not mine. I am what you call a steward or a tenant. I have been given blessings of that guitar or those books or that computer to do with as a proper steward should, to use them for entertainment, but also, and most hopefully, for the glory of God. And here's the deal. The simplest, easiest commandment given to the entire nation of Israel was that the first 10% of the harvest was to go to God. And it wasn't the cast-off things, because you only find the cast-off things at the end. But it was the first 10%, every 10 sheep. So the first 10 sheep, or the first one of 10 would go to God. And then the first one of the next 10 would go to God. And actually the first son would be dedicated to God. If you live in an agricultural community, it's actually quite easy to break off 10% or a tenth. It is quite difficult to find the worst things and offer them as sanctified to God. And actually, the Old Testament, the law says that if you try and do that, say you're trying to pass off a blind sheep for a really good one, both of them are forfeit to God because you're cheating the person who actually owns them. This is the easiest of all of the commandments to follow. And that's the starting point. The whole point of this is that God is calling Israel back to himself by saying, I want you to follow one commandment and one commandment alone right this instant. And that is the easiest one you can do. bring the full tithe into the storehouse, that there may be food in my house, and thereby put me to the test, says the Lord of hosts. If I will not open the windows of heaven for you and pour down for you a blessing until there is no more need. He says, try me. He doesn't say, worry about all this stuff. He says, put me to the test. Now, I'm going to pause here for a second. This is not the prosperity gospel. I'm not talking about seeding blessings. You do something and God has to do something back for you. That is what's called magic. And we don't do that here. I accomplish an action and therefore God has to do something in return. That's not how this works. God is calling people, specifically Israel, into obedience. We so often have it in our minds that the things in our lives are ours, and it's not ours. We're the stewards, right? We are called to use those blessings rightly. But in that, our first call is to fulfill the easiest and first law when it comes to those blessings, which is give it back to the owner. Luke 21 has probably one of the best interactions when it comes to giving. Luke 21, verses 1 through 4 says, Jesus looked up and saw the rich putting their gifts into the offering box. And he saw a poor widow put in two small copper coins. And he said, truly, I tell you, this poor widow has put in more than all of them. And for they all contribute out of their abundance, but she, out of her poverty, put in all she had to live on. The way in which the offering took place in the temple was, and I'm not completely sure, so we're going with a really exact description, was metal, kind of horn or bowl or funnel type thing. And what you do is you'd put your coins in it, and it would rattle and jingle and shake, and everybody could tell how much you were putting in. So if you put gold in there, it's going to make a specific sound, and people are going to be like, wow, that guy, he's really given to the Lord. Two little copper coins are going to go, bloop, bloop, and they're going to be like, wow. The thing is, though, the way that they give is more important than the amount. It's not about the money. It's an issue about the heart. The poor widow gave out of her love for the Lord, while the rich gave out of pride and a show. The poor widow had every right not to give everything she had to live on. In fact, to be really blunt, there were two ways that a poor widow with no family, so the only way she'd be a poor widow is if she had no living family, the only way that she would live was being a woman of the night or a beggar. She was not in a great financial situation. She wasn't in a great social situation. But even in that, she gave everything she had to the Lord because it was about her heart and who is in control. And for the rich, it was about showing off what they could do. I bet they were wearing really fine tunics and robes. She had nothing, and she gave everything out of that nothing. Today's gospel also gives us a look into the hearts of people. Number one, the gospel says, hey, we're going to try and trap Jesus. So we're going to throw him a really crafty, crafty question. And I had a dollar coin, but I think I left it in the back. It was going to be an example, but I'll explain it to you. So they say, is it lawful? Should we give taxes to Caesar? Now, you can answer with two different things. You can say, no, you shouldn't give to Caesar. And then the leaders of the temple would say, ha ha, he's trying to rebel against Rome. He needs to die. We'll send the soldiers in. They'll kill him. Done. Or you say yes, and then the leaders say, aha, he supports Rome. He's not really the Messiah. The Messiah is going to save us. He's going to bring us out of captivity and give us back the land. He's going to be the king. And that's what they were trying to catch him in. So Jesus, being who he is, says, hey, show me the money that you're supposed to pay taxes with. And they give him a denarius. And so it has an inscription, and it has the face of Caesar plastered on it. It's official. This is money. Side note, you couldn't use that in the temple. The temple, I mean, one of the Ten Commandments is that you shall not have any graven images. And because it has the face of Caesar, that's a graven image, you cannot use that in the temple. So, Jesus ends with, give unto Caesar what is Caesar's, and give unto God what is God's. And they were marveled and amazed. So, here's a couple things with this. Because you couldn't use it in the temple, you had to convert it into temple coin. If you've ever traveled internationally, money changers make money by changing money. You do not get the bank exchange rate unless you go to, like, the World Bank. Not even banks give you the exact true exchange rate. I grew up in Latin America. You found the best money changer. He'll give you the most amount of bolivianos or lempiras for your dollar. And he technically shortchanges you. Or she. That's how they make their money. The thing is, though, that coin, and this is why I had a $1 coin, because it's kind of big. I don't know if you know what a $1, this is actually an older one, 1979, I want to say. So it's as old as my older brother. Has a nice big picture. And it has a face of, I can't even remember who it is, but it has a face on it. So that coin would not be allowed to be used at the temple. My question for you is, in whose image was Caesar? I mean, on the coin is the image of Caesar. But whose image is Caesar? He's God's. Thank you very much. In Genesis, God creates man in God's image. So when Jesus says, give unto Caesar what is Caesar's and God unto God's, what is he saying? This is why they marveled at him because of this. Everything, even a graven image, is God's. Okay? We get stuck on the idea of giving tithes because we don't like giving up our things. And the gospel reading from 2 weeks ago actually talks about this. The gospel reading was about a vineyard and the tenants. And the tenants murdered the heir of the landowner. Specifically, that parable is speaking about Israel and what they were going to do to Jesus. But it was also teaching about stewardship. The evil tenants did not want to give to the landowner his rightful tithe. He didn't ask for everything that they had grown. He asked for their rent. That's all he's asking for. He owns the land. He owns everything. He owns this building. He owns the air that we breathe. It is right and just of said owner for him to request back what he is due. We give him praise, we give him worship, we give him tithes, not because we are forced to at gunpoint, but because he is worthy of it. Because we are not the evil, murderous tenants who want to kill the heir. We give back to him so that we are the good tenants, that we are blessed in the land, that we can delight in the blessings that God has given us. Today also, the reading for today also reminds us of something that's been going around in the world for quite a few years, I'll say, but it's really up front right now. God is not a socialist. He is in control. He owns everything. So technically speaking, he is like the worst dictator in the world, except he wants you to do well. So I guess he's not the worst dictator in the world, but he owns everything, and we are given specific things. In fact, in the Old Testament, he specifically gives to tribes. When Israel goes into the land, he gives tribes specific portions of land. And within those specific portions of land, he gives to specific families specific land that is theirs forever. It's not the communities. It's that families. And in fact, the year of Jubilee was so that if you had a bad steward of the land and they lost the land 50 years later, their family could get that land back. We are stewards of something that we think in our minds is ours, but has never been and never will be ours. Because truthfully, the only reason why we have life is because God's breath is breathing into us. We don't even own ourselves. So why would we think that we know better how to deal with things than God does? That, yet again, is the mark of insanity, because people have been doing that forever. The Anglican Church, just to be clear, actually has an article in the 39 articles that tells us what part of what we believe. And that says that we are not socialists. We believe in giving to the poor out of what has been given to us. We believe in taking care of widows and poor. I'm going to paraphrase, but actually one of the churches has a real paraphrase one, and it's like, it debunks the socialist idea that we're socialists. And it really does. It says that some people are called to have more and some people are called to have less, but out of whatever abundance you have, give. It's pretty much what it means. Now, here's the positive thing. I want to encourage you, Christ our King people, you guys have been wonderful tenants and stewards. We are not in need of money. Please continue to give. But as the world, as governments, let no crisis go unused, we, the church, let no tithing passage go unused. So we don't talk about tithing very much, but that's because we're teaching you about all of the teachings in the church. So when we do talk about this, it's not because we need your money. Well, we do. You pay for me, and you pay for Father Chuck, and you pay for this building, and you pay for the electricity. But I want to encourage you to stop thinking about things as mine or theirs or ours. It's his. My life is his. My breath is his. My thoughts are his. My tithes are his because he owns 100% of it. He's only asking for 10. He wants the best, though. And that's where we get caught up, because we want to be selective. And it's hard. It really is. I have never gone hungry, as one can see. But I'll tell you, there have been a couple months, not lately, since working here, obviously. But there was a time where I did not know if I was going to be able to pay the student loan that I had to pay or buy groceries and gasoline. And the Lord has always, always provided for me. I've not always been able to tithe monetarily, but I've been always able to tithe either work or service to the church because I really actually didn't have anything else to give. And it was with a joyful heart that I was able to use my strength for his kingdom, as it is joyful for me now to give monetarily and to tithe my work as well. And I pray that if you struggle with the tithe, he actually says, test him out. See how it goes. Follow him. Follow his first and simple commandment. Give him the number 1%. Give it to him first and see what he does with it. Because I can guarantee he's not going to let you just flounder and drown. I mean, he's yours. I mean, you're his, not he's yours. Well, he is yours, but you're his. And Jesus actually talks about, you know, how the Lord provides the flowers on the hills and provides for the birds of the air. And won't your Father provide better than just something like that for you? Somebody made in his image? Of course he will. Without a doubt. So I want to encourage you and teach you. And I hope that this wasn't too bad on tithing. Now, don't worry, it'll be a while before we have another one. May we continue to be faithful tenants of what the Lord has given to us as his stewards. Amen.